Hello and welcome to ID Talk, answers from an infectious disease expert. I'm Dr. Sean Elliott, a pediatric infectious disease specialist with Tucson Medical Center, professor emeritus of pediatrics at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, and long-term contributor to infectious diseases and immunizations topics at the Arizona chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. This podcast has been created to answer questions from our chapter's members about the COVID-19 pandemic and pretty much everything else infectious disease and infection prevention related. So this is the first full week of March, so it came in at least around our neck of the woods like a lamb. Should be interesting to see if it goes out like a lion, hard to say. But in terms of infectious diseases, we continue to see plenty of respiratory viruses and also an increase in, unfortunately, the gastrointestinal viruses. And one of our questions coming up is indeed about norovirus, so we'll talk about that. Other than that, though, we continue to see patients with sort of undifferentiated fever, which is due to a hodgepodge of occult pneumonias, urinary tract infections, and other fun things. So our colleagues and or yourselves, if you're tuning in from the emergency departments and urgent care centers, are keeping quite busy. But at least census-wise, in many parts of the pediatric hospitals around the country, things have slowed down just a little bit. So tiny little bit of breathing room, at least for the time being, until things start to amp up once again. So, as mentioned, we have fun questions. The first one, indeed, is to do with norovirus. And the questioner is noting that in the Northeast, there are plenty of norovirus cases. And do we think we'll see a similar trend in Arizona? And the answer is an unequivocal, oh, yeah. In fact, already have. So the CDC tracks data from four regions in the country, one of which, of course, is the Northeast. We in Arizona, in case you were from Arizona, tracked the Western region, which includes, of course, a good chunk of the West Coast and Pacific Northwest, but all four regions are showing a very similar increase in norovirus cases here for the winter months. And so reporting by the CDC through mid-February, so just a two-week lag, cases are continuing to increase and definitely on par to be a very typical winter peak in norovirus cases. These, by the way, are sort of epidemic-related, not necessarily outbreak-related. But of course, norovirus being so contagious, if you have one case in a closed setting, there are going to be plenty more. Hence, it's sort of a description as the cruise ship norovirus or cruise ship infection. And indeed, there are cruise ships currently, as we speak, that are having clusters of vomiting and diarrhea cases, presumably due to norovirus. But here in at least Arizona, and for those of you tuning up from elsewhere, certainly in the rest of the country, we continue to have sporadic cases in a very large number, and so plenty of patients presenting with dehydration due to a profuse emesis and diarrhea. Fortunately, it is a self-limited disease process. The major morbidity, hopefully not too much mortality, but morbidity is due to, in fact, dehydration and patients who are unable to sustain their hydration status. So they are coming to emergency department for IV hydration and or an oral rehydration challenge. And it is certainly quite reasonable just from the bad old days of cholera to attempt oral rehydration first before needing to send to a local setting for IV fluids and support like that. So yes, seeing plenty of norovirus. And along with that, unfortunately, there are going to be some bacterial enteritis. So differentiation between the two, norovirus, profuse, watery, non-bloody is the key word here, non-bloody, diarrhea and emesis, things like salmonellosis, shigellosis, and the most common, which is campylobacter, will have varying degrees of heme-positive and or grossly bloody stools with very prominent diarrhea and associated abdominal pain. Campylobacter is the one which is most like norovirus in that it can present with lower grade fevers, emesis first, and then 8 to 10 episodes of watery diarrhea in the daytime. So it might be difficult to differentiate campylobacter from norovirus. However, the vast majority of patients with campylobacter also improve spontaneously, and there's no indication for use of the typical treatment, which would be azithromycin. So one is not necessarily required to do either PCR testing with the GI panel or the specialized culture plates for campylobacter, because the outcomes, quite honestly, are going to be quite similar to norovirus. So spontaneous recovery, support the hydration, just keep an ear and eye open for something much more severe, such as a salmonella or shigella, or even worse, an enterohemorrhagic E. coli with the risk of hemolytic uremic syndrome. Blood, positive stools, severe abdominal crampy pain should be your hallmarks of concern if you have something other than norovirus or a spontaneously resolving campylobacter. All right, next question. Can I review the recent ACIP recommendations for Tdap in anticipation of a vaccine shortage? So in case one has not seen either the blast reports or the media coverage, one of the two manufacturers of the vaccine TD, which is big T, little d, which is the preferred vaccine, especially for a tetanus exposure and update adults, not so much kids, but adults, one of the two manufacturers, Mass Biologics, is discontinuing or has discontinued production of their vaccine, which is TD-Vax. However, there is another manufacturer, that's Sanofi, as in Sanofi Pasteur, that has its vaccine TenneVac, which is still big T, little d. However, that production of that vaccine is nowhere near enough to satisfy current demand in the United States, and Sanofi is going to tool up and start producing more. But the CDC and the ACIP anticipate a shortage of TD vaccine for 2024, hopefully resolving sometime in 2025. So what are we to do about that? And this is largely aimed at that older child who is already fully vaccinated with the primary series of DTaP, may have already received at least a booster with Tdap, who then has a high-risk tetanus exposure and normally would be getting TD. Well, that child or adult or adolescent or whomever else should now instead get Tdap, right? So just a routine, older patient booster with Tdap. And it certainly doesn't hurt that they're getting boosted against pertussis, since we still have plenty of pertussis outbreaks and clusters here in the United States. The one person who should not get the Tdap booster if they have a high-risk exposure or need TD should be that person who has a contraindication to the pertussis component. And who is that? That would be the patient who, as a child, had an encephalopathic process within 7 days after getting a pertussis vaccine. Very rare, certainly in the day and age of acellular pertussis vaccine, and very much an unusual phenomenon in pediatrics, but you may have that one patient in the country who had a true discernible encephalopathy after pertussis vaccine. So if that's the case, your patient should be able to get TD, even though it's in limited supply. That would be the one indication to use the TD vaccine versus the much more commonly available Tdap. So for the rest of us, just substitute Tdap in place of TD if the patient is due for a booster or needs an exposure, or sorry, post-exposure prophylaxis after a high-risk encounter. Okay, moving on along. Now, this one has a question to do with COVID. So I read that CDC is considering whether to recommend a spring COVID-19 booster shot for people at high risk for severe illness. Do I think this will be a good response or similar to the last booster? So importantly, this recommendation is using the same booster vaccine products that are currently available. So Novavax as the particle vaccine, and then the two mRNA vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer. Same booster vaccine that we have had access to since the start of the last mini surge, and that is not anticipated to change until next fall. So it would be a booster of the same type, mostly for those individuals who are perhaps higher risk of waning immunity, i.e. people at the extremes of age, certainly those who are older than age 60, and those who have underlying comorbidities such as chronic lung disease, chronic heart disease, obesity, etc. and so forth. So indeed, for those individuals, they would deserve a booster to continue to protect them against the continued low-level surge of the subvariants of Omicron. And we continue to see new ones emerging all the time. No increase in new disease, just a normal increase in infectivity. But for most of our pediatric patient population, with the exception perhaps of a high-risk patient with an immunodeficiency or significant immunosuppression, there will not be a need to do a spring booster. That said, coming to us next fall, and the thoughts are as early as next September or perhaps late summer, there is an anticipation of a newly formulated COVID-19 booster vaccine based on emerging trends for what is out there at the time. So in this, you can read a transition very much to typical practice behaviors for flu vaccine, right? So looking at what is circulating in other parts of the world, certainly what is circulating in the United States, predicting what might be circulating for the coming season, i.e. winter, and then formulating a new mRNA vaccine or Novavax vaccine to reflect that and then to administer it. So we are absolutely settling into flu-like illness vaccine practices, and also, since you probably saw this as well, flu-like isolation and removal from isolation practices. So in case you didn't happen to see this beautiful little tidbit from CDC and the media, we are now able to relax our return to work and return to school practices for patients with COVID-19. So rather than what used to be staying in quarantine for 5 days minimum after onset of illness and up to 10 if still symptomatic, now the isolation and removal from quarantine is being afebrile in the absence of antipyretics and otherwise asymptomatic. So it's a much gentler and more open return to school or work quarantine practice recommendations, very much like we currently do for influenza and other respiratory viruses. So fever gone for 24 hours, no additional antipyretics, fine to return to school, play group, preschool, work, et cetera, and so forth. So there you go. So COVID-19 is settling into much more of an epidemic approach and further away from the pandemic. And that is reflected in vaccine practices. Probably every fall, we'll see a new vaccine formulation being released and otherwise sort of returning in a bizarre way to business as usual. Blessing and a curse, I guess, but it's a good thing to be moving forward. Last question has to do with HPV, so human papillomavirus. And the questioner writes, in a recent article I read, it highlighted the association between HPV and an increased risk for heart disease and stroke. What might this mean in terms of screening, prevention, and treatment among individuals with a history of HPV? So the study, actually, that our questioner is asking about was published in early February, and it comes to us from South Korea. In this study, they looked at over 160,000 Korean women who are at least 30 years of age and older who had a history of infection with a high-risk HPV virus subtype. And they looked at them for onset or death from medical illness. What they found was that those women who had a history of high-risk HPV infection had a four-fold higher risk of death from heart disease and a six-fold higher risk of death from stroke compared to women who did not have infection with a high-risk HPV virus serotype. So that is specific to women who are age 30 and older. No pediatric patients, no males were recruited. So as the study authors write, say, there is concerning association, absolutely, in these women who had those fourfold and sixfold higher risks of death by heart disease and stroke. There were also comorbidities associated, and it's hard to look at or control for the impact potentially of onset of menopause, of estrogen, of other factors unique to women. So new studies are being proposed to look at men, and I anticipate ultimately we'll also look at a lifelong risk of children who had exposure to or infection with a high-risk HPV virus serotype, and what their lifetime risk is as well. So very much like the Farmingham study, we have, a lot of exciting, interesting possibilities yet to go, but so far no alarm bells are being sounded, and certainly no cause for concern for our pediatric patients. All of that said, then, we also need to look at the potential beneficial effect of vaccination with an HPV vaccine, and might that potentially remove or at least mitigate the risk as, you know, our young women turn into older women here in the United States. And the likelihood is that yes, a vaccine has a great potential to reduce or mitigate to a certain extent the higher risk of death by heart disease and stroke. Similarly, for boys and their lifelong risk of cancer, it's certainly genital cancer, testicular cancer, etc., so too might we see a decreased risk in women for these other issues if they are vaccinated as well. So it does not mean much for us in pediatrics, at least not based on the available data, in terms of screening, prevention, or treatment of our patients with HPV infection. But it does mean much in terms of another reason to promote and support vaccination in our adolescents and early teens with and against HPV with the vaccine. So add this to your armamentarium of positive endorsement conversations to have with those individuals considering HPV vaccine. And certainly I think we can add it to our list of really good idea to get vaccine now to avoid much risk, higher risk later on in life. So there you go. That is it for the questions. Not a whole lot else to report at this time. As we move into the spring and then summer months, we can certainly anticipate onset of vector-associated infections, meaning those carried by mosquitoes and ticks and other biting fun things. So especially for those of us practicing in border states, i.e. in proximity to Mexico, it's time to re-familiarize yourself with the presentation of dengue, Zika, and chikungunya, just in large part because those mosquito vectors, i.e. the Aedes albopictus and Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, are already present in the southern part of the United States and other parts as well. And those three viruses, dengue, Zika, and chikungunya, already exist in parts of Mexico and certainly in Central and South America. So it is truly only a matter of time, hopefully longer rather than shorter, when we start to see an increase in those cases acquired natively here in the United States, and in anticipation of travelers who have spent time across the border and or our incoming immigrant population, it is wise for us to familiarize ourselves with those presentations. Similarly with malaria, which every year is coming up, especially from South and now Central America, and certainly incoming immigrant population from Africa. So 'tis the season, my friends, and if you haven't recently familiarized yourself, please feel free to do so and or send it as a question to the podcast, and we'll flag that to talk about in a subsequent time. So in the meantime, and as always, thank you all for listening to ID Talk. Arizona AAP members can submit questions for future episodes to covid@azaap.org. The Arizona AAP would like to acknowledge the generous support of this podcast by the Arizona Department of Health Services through the Title V Maternal and Child Health Services Block Grant Funding. For more information and resources related to COVID-19 in Arizona and other infectious diseases, or to learn how to become a member, please visit us at azaap.org. And as always, keep fighting the good fight. Thank all of you for your service. Stay away from the norovirus and those vectors. Good luck, everyone.